Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Orpheus was founded in 1972 by a group of like-minded young musicians determined to combine the intimacy and warmth of a chamber ensemble with the richness of an orchestra. They perform without a conductor, rotating musical leadership roles for each work with a focus on presenting diverse repertoire through collaboration and open dialogue as a way of placing democracy at the center of artistic execution. It's been the focus of studies at Harvard University and of leadership seminars at IBM, Morgan Stanley, Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, among others, and Orpheus has been bringing its unique approach to students of all ages through its worldwide education and engagement programs. Access Orpheus New York City, Orpheus Music Academy, Orpheus Leadership Institute, and the newest project, Orpheus Reflections, designed for people with Alzheimer's and dementia and their caregivers. Joining us now is the group's executive director, Alexander Sharley, and we have an added treat. Cellist James Wilson and flutist Elizabeth Mann will be performing live in our studio. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Alexander, if Orpheus is leadership, what are your duties as its executive director?
Well, we have what we call a shared governance. So we have an administration, we have the musicians, we have the board, and I'm the head of the administration, but it's a very very collegial and very collaborative spirit there.
And you're not a musician?
I am a musician by training. I'm a cellist, actually.
What do you prefer, orchestra, ensemble? Are they interchangeable as far as you're concerned?
I guess it's defined by the size, really. We play sometimes with 3, 4, 5 people, up to 40. You can call it an ensemble. It's always, ensemble playing is like you play together as an ensemble, as a chamber music, and you can do that up to 40 people, no problem.
40 people is a small orchestra.
That's considered, I would say, a large chamber orchestra, a small symphony orchestra.
Haven't orchestras always had conductors? Doesn't a conductor play a major role in deciding how a piece will be interpreted? The same piece performed by the New York Philharmonic will sound different depending on who's conducting.
That's correct. So when Orpheus attempted to, or first started to play without a conductor, it was the first ensemble ever, or first orchestra ever, to make that attempt. And it was groundbreaking. I mean, nobody had ever attempted doing that. And so, yes, of course it sounds different. And, we rotate our concertmaster. I mean, every position rotates all the time. So we may play one piece again with, and rotating positions, and it will sound different.
And isn't one of the roles of the conductor to keep the whole thing together? I remember that when I sang in choirs and choruses, some conductors got much better performances out of us than others.
That's correct, and that's, of course, challenging. If you don't have a conductor, then, of course, your chamber music skills, playing together, looking at each other, and, being really in close contact with each other is what everybody has to do. Otherwise, it won't work.
Elizabeth, how are decisions made? Does a flute player's opinions have as much clout with Orpheus as someone in the string section?
Depends who's playing flute, but yes, it is a democratic process, so we really are supposed to have equal voice. I mean, in general, like democracy, some people still speak more than others. The concertmaster, I would say, has a little more of a prominent role because it's not that they're the conductor, but they kind of oversee the rehearsals. And also, we have something called a core process where we get the principal players together of each section before the whole group meets. And we just kind of get an idea of what's our vision for the piece so that there isn't, it's never anarchy at rehearsals, but things can get quite heated. And sometimes we actually have to vote on how we're going to play a phrase.
But even large symphonies have concert masters.
That's right. One thing that happens in Orpheus rehearsals, you'll see everybody sitting with a score. We all have to be more participatory, and we have to step up in our role as an artistic entity to the group, there's no falling asleep in the back of the orchestra, because you really have to be engaged with the movement of the music and the decisions, the musical decisions. So in some ways, some people would say we're actually getting rid of the middleman.
You must have worked with conductors for all of your life until you joined Orpheus.
And continue to.
What are the advantages for you as a musician to perform in this more democratic situation?
Having a voice is a wonderful feeling and empowering. I think everybody feels that way in the group. You don't always like the conductors you get, so you have to, take the good and the bad. And if you don't have a conductor, there is a real importance in making sure you're making a statement, because often it's the conductor who is making the statement. So it's very exciting playing in Orpheus and having the freedom to really participate with the music making. And of course, there is a very long process to become a member of Orpheus, because it's not necessarily the best thing if you don't feel comfortable speaking your ideas.
Yeah, I remember a story musicians told. I think it was about Bruno Walter conducting, and somebody in the back of the orchestra or horn section or whatever pulled out binoculars. You know the story? You're nodding your head.
I think I do.
And Walter said, what's this all about? And he said, just searching for the downbeat, maestro.
Yeah, that's as musicians all can relate to those moments.
Alexander, hasn't Orpheus trademarked its signature mode of operation, the Orpheus process, to the point where that phrase is followed by an R in a circle?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you trademark a method of performance?
You trademark the name, mm-hmm. right?
But anybody can borrow it from you. The approach?
Yeah, but we've been the first group to do it, and we have a pretty solid program communicating it and teaching it, actually. And, there's other ensembles that were founded after the Orpheus principle, and, not just musical entities, but other organizations too. And they use it, and they even say, we work, under the guidance of the Orpheus process, and that's fine.
But you were the first in 1972?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, but of course, string quartets work similarly. Usually just one person will nod and everybody knows it's time to start.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same. So what our group of musicians in 1972 tried to accomplish is use that chamber music setting with four, five, six musicians and play the larger repertoire for like 20 to 30 musicians.
And how do you decide what is going to be in the repertoire? But you do play the recognizable composers, the famous ones, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, etc.
Of course.
But also, haven't you commissioned 48 original works?
Yes, we have done that too. So it really depends. And we have an artistic we have artistic directors, three of them. They're elected by the musician body. And then they meet with some members of the staff regularly, once a week. Actually, we discuss program options, pieces, and where we would offer them, for which of our series here in New York City or on tour. And it depends really on the market. I mean, you can't, depending on where you go, let's say you go to the southern states, you have a different program than if you go to California, for instance. And so that's how we determine programs. That's what we offer.
I'm curious about that. Mm. What wouldn't you play in the South that you play here? I mean, right now you could play music that refers to snow.
Yeah, I guess it largely depends on the population and the presenters and their audience. So what you would do is you talk to the presenters, and they will tell you about their audience, what their audience is used to hear, and then you try to, to broaden their, knowledge about music. And
And today we'll be hearing two different pieces.
Right.
One is by a composer who's been dead for a long time, so I'm assuming that wasn't commissioned by Villa-Lobos. But the other is fairly new. Was it commissioned by Orpheus? Elizabeth?
I have to interject here. I play with another group, the Orchestra of St. Luke's, the St. Luke's mm-hmm. Chamber Ensemble, and several years back, they had a commissioning program, and this piece that we're playing by Gabriella and Lana Frank a little later in the program, was commissioned by St. Luke's and written for me. And it's sort of a funny story is that Jim and I, when we were looking for repertoire, there's not a lot of music written for flute and cello. And I looked in my pile and I found two pieces, which happened to be two of the hardest pieces. And amazingly enough, Jim said, there's this great piece that Gabriella Elena Frank wrote. And I was like, oh, I think I know that piece. And then I realized I had not played it for 15 years, but Jim had actually played it quite a bit recently. And I was so pleased to hear this piece that was written, you know, for me, that was actually played. So we're very happy to revisit this piece.
Well, we're talking as though Orpheus isn't well known, but it's very well known, performs all over the world, and you have your own record label, and you've also recorded for pretty much all the majors.
Yes, all the major labels. We just actually had another recording with the Deutsche Grammophon label this August. It will be released in January.
You won a Grammy for Deutsche Grammophon, mm-hmm. the Shadow Dances Stravinsky Miniatures.
Right. Yeah, we have over 70 albums on the market, actually.
Now, it's different today than it used to be when records were the way an orchestra became best known.
I believe that the physical CD is pretty much dead, but you still need to have recordings.
I still have a CD player.
Well, so do I, right? But trying to explain that to my kids, what that means, it's hard, you know? But you still need to have recordings. You have to make recordings, because otherwise people can't stream your recordings, listen to you. And we're still heavily involved in the recording process.
And so what determines whether you record something on your own label, or whether you do it on Deutsche Grammophon, Sony Classical, EMI Classics, BMG, RCA, Red Seal, Decca?
It's repertoire driven, pretty much. If a major label comes to you and say, hey, could you record Mendelssohn symphonies for us, then we would certainly do that. If we want to go more progressive and do something contemporary or something more challenging, then, you know, major labels are, you know, they need to sell their recordings and make money, and they may not be able to do that with more challenging or lesser known pieces. So I think that's the determination.
And the more challenging ones have a special appeal for the Orpheus people?
You know, each and every music at some point was contemporary music, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we have a responsibility of commissioned pieces and composers create new works. And sometimes the pieces are just wonderful and great and will survive, and other times they won't, but you don't know until you've played them. And I'm quite happy that we continue commissioning pieces, but it's not, you know, your core audience is, we are not a contemporary music ensemble per se. We can play all this music, but it's not our core repertoire.
But even during my lifetime, styles have changed.
Oh, right.
Serial music was dominant for a while, then minimalist. What are we hearing today?
You mean here in the studio?
I mean, what do composers who were not committed to other earlier styles composing like today?
I want to say that composers are always holding a mirror to society and what's going on in daily life and the situation, and they try to put that into music. And what music means, I mean, look back to Mozart. It was pure entertainment. And it was completely differently received, the Mozart back then, than it's received today. And the same is with contemporary music today. Mm-hmm.
We forget that Bach was not rich during his lifetime.
No.
Considering how he's enriched music, you would have wished that he had been a billionaire as a result of what he composed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm speaking with Alexander Shiley, who is the executive director of Orpheus. And we have two musicians from the ensemble with us, cellist James Wilson and flutist Elizabeth Mann. And this is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. The first piece you're going to play is by Heitor Villa-Lobos. Did I pronounce his name right?
I believe
so. He was Brazilian.
That's right. He was Brazilian, and it's interesting because you were just talking about motivations for composers, and, you know, he was really sort of a street musician in Brazil, and his parents, you know, influenced him to play. I think his father taught him cello, and he really loved the music of the street. And so that's sort of, it's very folksy music. And he did a lot, he wrote a lot of chamber music, and very lucky to have this incredible piece, The Jet Whistle.
He's become a part of the regular repertoire for orchestras all over the world.
That's
so
right.
He obviously was pretty good.
That's right.
And we're going to be hearing a semblo agiato, which means the jet whistle. Do we have any idea where that name, what that name refers to, James? No, it's okay. Just
yeah,
you're off.
Well,
James
well,
is I, off I, mic right now, but
yeah, I believe that the story may be apocryphal, but I think that Villa-Lobos at one point was in the jungle someplace, a coffee-growing region, and there was a coffee machine that had used steam, like an espresso machine, and we've all heard that sound in coffee shops all over New York City, especially here in Brooklyn. Right, so there's this kind of like steam overload sound, and he decided to use the flute to imitate that. It's a novelty for sure, but it makes a great title for this piece.
No, it's a not. It's only under 10 minutes, but it has three sections. So we start off with Allegro, then go to Adagio, and then Vito. It's Heitor Villa-Lobos' Assemblo Agiato, performed by James Wilson and Elizabeth Mann. Thank you. Peter Villa-Lobos' Assemblo Agiato, performed so beautifully by James Wilson on cello and Elizabeth Mann on flute, reminding us that those two instruments are often the ones that sound closest to the sounds we hear in nature, because the flute reminds us of the sounds of birds, and the cello probably comes closest to the sound of the human voice. And Alexander... doesn't the group often present unexpected musical combinations? For example, last month you presented a performance by Israeli mandolinist Avi Avital and Latvian accordionist Ksenija Sidorova. Those aren't instruments that we normally associate with so-called classical music.
That's right. That's exactly why we did it. We thought we should just, you know, we always wanted to play with Avi and Ksenija, and then we thought, well, let's just pair them up and play with them together and present our audience at Carnegie Hall something very different.
So were the pieces that you played, that they played, commissioned by Orpheus?
So there's, so we asked them to play with us, and they've played together without orchestra as a duo many times for many years. And so we said, okay, let's play together with Orpheus and we'll find some music. Well, we went on a hunt and research, and we came up with zero. There's no music. So we decided to have our good friend Paul Chihara, he's on our board, he's a film music composer, he arranged a double concerto by Bach for these two instruments, and then we also commissioned a piece by film music composer Benjamin Wallfisch.
James, I imagine there aren't too many pieces that have been commissioned over the years for cello and flute.
No, there haven't been, and there's kind of a, you know, cello and flute were very popular back in, say, the Baroque era, when cello was part of, say, a continuo ensemble that would play with a solo flute. And then during the 19th century, the forces were just too small for people's tastes. People liked bigger ensembles like string quartets and string sextets, and if they had winds and they had like horn and clarinet and piano. And then just very recently, say, the later part of the 20th century. People started to write again for flute. And flutists in general tend to be big advocates for contemporary music, as do cellists, because we historically don't have the repertoire that, say, violins or pianists have. Mm. So,
although Bach wrote some pretty nice pieces.
Yeah, always, that's the pinnacle right there. The first pieces were the pinnacle. It's kind of sad.
My guests are cellist James Wilson, flutist Elizabeth Mann, and Alexander Charlie, who is the executive director of Orpheus. And talking about Orpheus, now, James, did either of you attend the Orpheus Music Academy programs, or is that something that came along after you were members of Orpheus?
This is a program that we use to train the future musicians of our profession in kind of the Orpheus way of playing without a conductor in the Orpheus process. And
does that actually have to be taught?
Yes, it has to be taught. Either that or it has to be learned over years of experience. And you know, you can't quite do that in 2 weeks. And so it's a great way to teach people to have these kind of superhuman ensemble skills that you need to be in an orchestra that doesn't function with a conductor. And the Music Academy is something that we're starting up this summer. We had done it before as kind of a pilot program several years ago. That was before my time in Orpheus. So I'm excited to see it reboot.
So what happens in these classes? Musicians curious about how to proceed?
Yeah, so we will, this program that we're starting up this summer, it's called Orpheus Institute, and we will pick repertoire for a small orchestra, say only about 9 violins, 4 violas, etc. Winds, only a couple of each woodwind, plus a little extra. We pick repertoire for them and we assign them. The goal is to play a concert at the end of a week, which is a very tight schedule, but that's what Orpheus does. So we're using that as a model.
And then they talk to the musicians also, pick your brains?
Yeah, so we'll probably have to prep them on processes and what works and what doesn't when you don't have a conductor, and then we'll be observing rehearsals.
Alexander, was the Academy what inspired your latest creation, Orpheus Reflections? Because that's also about interacting with the people you're performing to.
Yeah, for a while we had been talking about, I mean, our outreach and educational programs are really, really excellent. And but we had started to talk, you know, any orchestra, we always talk about your audience, you talk about your children, educational programs and so forth. And at some point we just started talking about, what are we doing for the population that's not, you know, kids and that's not coming to our concert or not able to come to our concert? For instance, you know, with the elderly or the ones that are living with any form of dementia, Alzheimer's, for instance. And that got us thinking, and that started Orpheus Reflections.
So you created it in partnership with the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. I throw this out to you, James and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Do people who have Alzheimer's or dementia respond to music in a way that they might not respond to other things?
Yes, because medically what happens with Alzheimer's disease is that the brain collapses, and oftentimes what's really down at the core of the brain, I'm sorry, I'm not being more scientific with it, but this is just my explanation. What's at the core is the memory of things like music. And so oftentimes in our Reflections program, we'll play for people and you'll see people who haven't responded to anything for a while all of a sudden kind of come to life and clap their hands. And it's a really wonderful moment, especially for those of us like me and Liz who have backgrounds of Alzheimer's in our families.
Mm-hmm. And Liz, I want to get you onto this mic here. What kinds of questions do the people who, the audience members ask you? What do they want to talk about? Because I think this is an incredible program.
It really is. In some ways, this program has touched me more than anything we've been doing. And I love so much about Orpheus, but my mother passed away last year from Alzheimer's and had former dementia. And
so this has special significance.
Extremely. Right? And she's the one who started me on music. And my mother came to life every time I would play. She would remember all the words when she couldn't speak. And when Alexander started telling me about this program, I was so interested. But then I recently did a couple of these, and it's like our most amazing audience. They are so receptive to what music does for us and what and how they respond to it. I mean, they were crying, they were laughing, they were asking the most incredibly articulate questions when they hadn't spoken, and they would come up and say, I can't get the words out quite, but I just want to say this has made me the happiest I've been, you know, in the last couple of months just hearing the music. So it's a very visceral, immediate impact I think we've all felt playing in these reflections. And as, again, Alexander said, you know, we always concerned about playing for children, and not so much as much attention has been about giving concerts to elderly people. So,
it's, but you also do play for children. You have access to Orpheus, New York City,
a lot,
and that that involves K to 12 public school students,
Title I schools. Yeah, mainly. So we invite up to 700 children to each of our concerts at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, if anybody comes to our concerts at Carnegie Hall, I encourage them to go and look up in the last balcony, which will be full of students.
Well, there was a time when I went to high school when music programs, there were a lot of music programs, but haven't they pretty much been eliminated or cut back because of budget concerns?
Sadly so, yeah. So, I mean, all the orchestras in the city and all over the country are, you know, taking up what the public school system should be doing, really. So we're going to the school, we're teaching them, we're presenting our music, we invite them to our concerts and all that sort of stuff. And it's so important. It is just so important.
Now, the other piece that you have told us you're going to play is, I guess, not the sort of thing you would play for kids or for people with Alzheimer's?
No, absolutely. I think we would. Actually, the last concert, we played The Reflection, we played a very contemporary piece, and nobody screamed or came up and grabbed our instruments out of our faces.
This is by a composer pianist with an interesting background, multicultural, multi-ethnic, Lithuanian, Jewish, Peruvian, and Chinese as well.
I know, but I do think the one part of her that she has really focused on a lot of is her Peruvian background. And this piece we're going to play is really from her visit to a museum about Peruvian art.
She's from Berkeley, California, but this is about pre-Incan, well, it's called Four Pre-Incan Sketches, or Cuatro Bosquejos Pre-Inca Icos. Composer is Gabriela Lena Frank, and our musicians are James Wilson on cello and Elizabeth Mann on flute. And here are those four pre-Incan sketches. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gabriela Lena Frank's Cuatro Bosquejos Pre-Incaicos, performed in our studios by James Wilson and Elizabeth Mann. I wonder how some of those sounds were notated, because some of those breathing, odd breathing sounds. Does she say breathe weirdly into the mic?
Yes, basically, breathy, very breathy. Yeah, it's interesting. We didn't tell you a lot about the effect of sounds, and it's like panpipes and all of the old flutes you would hear back in the
meant to evoke feelings of the Amazon.
Absolutely, at the Amazon, all of the Inca tribes, and I think the flutes, these are two of the oldest instruments actually. But I'm sitting here with a silver modern flute, trying to overblow and all these different effects. And of course, Jim has a whole a range of effects he's doing.
Well, he gets to play a lot of pizzicato with that piece.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Was that composed for Orpheus?
It was not composed for Orpheus, but it is one of the few pieces for flute and cello that I've played before. We've both played them before. So I've played it with St. Luke's, and
Now, Alexander, Orpheus Chamber Orchestra Engagement Initiatives has been the focus of studies at Harvard University and leadership seminars at IBM, Morgan Stanley, Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, among others. How can Orpheus's approach be applied to what happens in an investment banking house or in a hospital?
Yes, that's a good question. And every time we go to these companies, corporations, and to our leadership institute, then you see big question marks on participants' face. What is an orchestra doing here? Why are they here and giving us giving us their time and talking about themselves? So, usually when you have an orchestra, a symphony orchestra, chamber orchestra, you have a conductor, and translate that into a company structure or corporation. You have like one person in front of the team, which in our case is the orchestra, and that's the conductor is that one person, and that person tells you what to do, how fast to play, what pieces to play, and all these decisions are made by this one person. And translated into a company is like you have a team, a large team, and there's one person that tells you, that micromanages all the other people in the team.
Call the boss or the manager.
Call the boss. Yes, exactly. And so we're not saying what we're doing is better. It's just completely different. And so when Harvard did a case study on us, and they're still teaching it even after 25 years at Harvard Business School, it's called No Leader on the Podium. But not having one leader doesn't mean we're leaderless. We're actually exactly the opposite. We're leaderful because everyone has to step up, and because everyone then has feels empowered and has a stake in the game.
Well, James, you are assistant director as well as a cellist.
Yeah, I'm one.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I'm one of the three artistic directors. I'm the artistic coordinator of the orchestra, and our artistic director positions are, again, chosen through a very democratic process. We're elected from within the orchestra, so we're all orchestra members.
And what happens if somebody says, "I hate this piece"?
there are always people that say that.
Not surprised.
Both in the orchestra and from the audience reaction. It's just something that people are very opinionated. And I personally like people with opinions. I'd rather hear people have that reaction than no reaction at all. And it's just something that you have to take into account going forward, but also you have to stick to your guns artistically and say, no, this is why we did this piece. This is why it's important to us and the orchestra. And just sit with it for a while and see if your opinion changes.
My brother just reviewed a book in the Times by, what's his first name, Tomasini? Mm-hmm. And he listed the 17 composers he thought were most important, and everybody complained that he left out Mahler. They could have complained he left out Liszt as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Tastes are different.
There's a lot of great music out there.
Yeah, there's, I mean, the man, I mean, when we're talking about the classical music world, and I'll even put that in quotes, because it's just so much music from so, like, hundreds of years, you know, and pieces are always being discovered, historical pieces are always being discovered. Like Alexander said, new music is written every day. I don't know how, I would love to know how many new pieces are written every day.
And then tastes change. And then, there are periods where certain composers are really incredibly popular, and other periods where they go into decline for a while.
Right. I mean, take Mahler for a case. Like, he was tremendously unpopular for a long time. No one played his music, and then through Leni Bernstein, then he helped do a revival. Or Bach, for that matter. You know, back with Mendelssohn.
It was Mendelssohn who rediscovered him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we don't have much time left, but Alexander. You mentioned earlier that the orchestra tours extensively. Where are you going this year?
This season? Well, it's a very busy season for us. We're going to an extensive tour to Germany, actually, in May of next year. Well, we start in Spain in March, and then we go to Asia in April, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, China.
Oh,
and,
this sounds really rough.
Japan. Well, yeah.
And how do I join?
It's not that much fun. It's a lot of work. That's what we do. That's,
you
that's
don't get
our job.
Get much sightseeing in?
Well, look, I mean, yes, it's work, but it gets you around the world, and you may not get a lot of sightseeing in, but it's great to be in these places, you know. I mean, it's, you know, it's a lot of travel, lots of different time zones and everything, but it's wonderful. I mean, we're playing at the major stages, you know, of this world.
So. And you have series at two major New York venues, Carnegie Hall and the 92nd Street Y. Are those seasons over?
No, we just played last night at the 92nd Street Y, actually.
What did you play?
Well, we played one piece by Hans Rott that was the U.S. premiere, but that piece was like 120 years old. Mm. It's never been played here.
Yeah, and we also played Mahler's arrangement of the Schubert Death and the Maiden Quartet. Mm. Really fantastic. And Rott was a friend of Mahler's, so we had a program tie-in with that.
So you're teaching the audience at the same time.
That's education, yeah.
Well, it's more like broadening their horizon because, I mean, we all love to play Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn. It's fantastic, but we also don't want to just create a museum. And you know, we want to feature other composers, other works that people don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. And when you play the War Horses, it's nice, but people already know those pieces.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people are really appreciative to hear a piece that they haven't heard before. And the audience really likes it.
Well, I really appreciate what you've performed for us today. My great thanks to you, James Wilson, Elizabeth Mann, for performing live in our studio, and Alexander Schreiley, Executive Director of Orpheus, for bringing them along. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you for having us.
Pleasure's ours.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Elizabeth Mann, Alexander Schreiley, and James Wilson of Orpheus, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robinhood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.